Welcome to the Aesthetic City podcast. In this show, we aim to discover how to go forward and create a more livable, beautiful, and healthy built environment. I'm Ruben Hansen, your host and founder of the Aesthetic City. Today's guest is an esteemed academic architectural historian. He is known for significant contributions to the understanding of architectural history of antiquity, particularly through his seminal work on the Pantheon. Even more compelling is that our guest doesn't limit himself to only historical research, but is a practicing architect at his own firm, Apollodorus Architecture. Previously an associate professor at the University of Bath, he has authored multiple scholarly books and countless articles. Additionally, he serves as chair of the Traditional Architecture Group and has taught at the Center for the Study of Classical Architecture Summer School at Cambridge and the Summer School of La Table Ronde d'Architecture in Bruges. He recently put forward an exciting counterproposal for the renovation and replacement of the Bath Rugby Stadium, which has caught the attention and sparked the imagination of many. So without further ado, please welcome Mark Wilson-Jones. Welcome, Mark, and thank you so much for being on The Aesthetic City on such a short notice as well.
That's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, Ruben.
Yeah. We first of all, we met in Poundbury during the IMCL Congress this year, 2023, and I already had seen your wonderful design in Bath before I knew who you were, although I have seen your name come across a couple of times. But first of all, really short, what did you think of the conference?
I thought it was great. Actually, it's my first IMCL conference. That's the international Making Cities Livable, isn't it? And I think making cities livable is so important, making them more human and trying to combat some of the alienation that has crept in the 20th century. And it's really important. And so to have also the evidence from, say, neuroscience or from simple observation or projects that have been built from the theory to the practice. No, it was all great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also had a great time meeting a lot of new people, interesting people in this space. So, yeah, but maybe first of all, could you tell a bit about your background and mainly what led to your interest in architecture in your formative years?
I think that's probably a fairly common thing. You know, if you're quite good at school and mathematics and science, and you're also quite good at art, or you think you are, you know, then they tend to come together, and you think you don't really want to go just down the sort of more science route. And I was also very interested in history of art, and the art exam I did, it's called A levels. That had quite a one paper in art history, and I got really into that. So I had my sort of strange combination. I'm not very good at languages, but English literature, okay, and writing, and the essay writing, and then the art, drawing, and the physics and maths, chemistry being that good. So it just seemed to, architecture came to suggest itself, really, as one of the things that was possible. So it was that kind of, I wasn't thinking I had to be an architect when I was 11 or something. But then getting into it and then doing the degree, I must say at Cambridge, it was so fantastic to be there as a student. I didn't do much work in my first year. I think that's a very common experience. Then did a little bit more in the second year. Yeah. Finally, by the third year, I was really getting pretty interested. And then I had a two-year break working on site as a site engineer, but actually physically laying out buildings and so on. So that was really illuminating. And I worked in a London office, and I went out to Sri Lanka to work for the great Jeffrey Bawa. And that was a fantastic experience. So then you come back to do your, what we call the part two, the master's, you know, left as a boy really, and you come back slightly older boy, at least, or a young man with some experience. And then I really got stuck in for the master's, and it went really well. And that sent me going, and then really became pretty passionate about the subject.
So yeah, it was kind of a gradual process of getting more and more into art history and architecture, because you became an architect, but then there was a switch. Could you tell a little bit about, also perhaps the reason you became attracted to classical architecture and antiquity?
Yeah, so I mean, at college in those days, as in most places, there was a presumption in favor of modernist practice. But the Polytechnic of Central mm-hmm. London, where I went for the master's, was a very interesting place, because it had a kind of almost unit system, and it had different currents. And there was one current influenced by people like Dalibor Vesely, who was teaching at Cambridge, ironically, just after I left, and people like Eric Parry. It was a sort of more phenomenological view of design. And then there was also Dimitri Porphyrios with a more classical, traditional view of design. I didn't actually join his unit, but I had friends who did. So we were quite exposed to a less, let's say, a less canonical view. And then, because I continue to be really interested in history, I did a pretty good dissertation, let's be honest. And then I won the Rome Prize. So for that, when I went to Rome, at Rome, which was 2 years, which is amazing to be paid to just, you know, imbibe yourself in immerse yourself in Rome. I did a kind of historical project that also involved drawing. So this was the study of Peruzzi's Palazzo Massimo. It's an incredible building in the center of Rome. So there's a historical study of that, and then also the drawing, surveying. There was scaffolding. I could do a completely new survey. The measuring, working out the proportions of geometry, and Peruzzi's obsessions. And because of his ideas and his own obsession with antiquity, that drew me back to try and, if you like, follow his ideas back to the roots. And then you become kind of entranced by these amazing buildings, just like someone like Louis Kahn, or you know, all these people have come to Rome from well before the Grand Tour, and then still into the 20th century. So I just got fascinated in it. But the difference between, I mean, the normal thing would be fascinated, learn a lot, and go back and practice as an architect, which I did. But I also got the bug to the sufficient extent of having ideas about research and then publishing the ideas. So, and then the publications became quite well known in their field, and then I did more and so on. So it kind of gathered momentum without me really meaning, I wouldn't have known as a student end up doing this. It becomes, you know, with architects and with other creative people, you do get a bug at a certain point. You get certain things that obsess you, and you maybe go down that road. And I was torn between more design things and historical work. And I was a bit unlucky in my own design proto-career, because although I built a house really early, it was completely messed up. Not through my own fault, because I was in Rome, and then that's a terrible decision. My girlfriend at the time, she just cried at a distance of 15 meters when she saw it, you know, going down the street. So, you know, it was messed up. Another project cancelled, another one that was sort of halfway through, and then it was delayed for the government couldn't come up with the money. This was in Portugal. I had then a master plan project cancelled. And so if those things had gone well, I would have probably carried on as an architect. But since I was a bit unlucky, and then the publications became known, I ended up going down the scholarship route. So it's just life. Mm-hmm. It's relatively random how some of these things happen.
Because I've seen you have a lot of publications to your name, but recently you have restarted your career. Isn't that right? And so how did you reboot that architectural career? How did that come to pass?
Well, I didn't consciously reboot it. It rebooted itself. It something came to me. It was really quite curious. About 5 years ago or so, I was creating a design project. A research project, looking at the use of precedent, particularly ancient precedent, how it was used in the Renaissance and the neoclassical period, and even the present day. And I had a kind of particular line on this that really trying to go against the idea that people presume that, I know, classical architecture involves common, which actually is quite rare. And it's no more common than it is for modern architects to to copy, borrow from each other, riff off each other, and so on. This is the way it goes. We all learn from each other. I was developing this research project to do this kind of work. And then, it ended up that I got a call, that one thing led to another, that ended up me not just writing about the use of precedent and how one designs in the classical tradition, mm-hmm. but actually doing it. So this sort of dream project came my way completely unexpected, yeah. because the patron was contacting me as an academic expert to create a project, to create it and guide it and steer it so that towards the choice of an architect, towards going forward and keeping some rigor. But as he didn't realize that I had been an architect and I still drew, I still watercolored, I still, did these activities, design mm-hmm. sometimes. And so after a while, we saw the site, got into a kind of a groove with the design and a rapport, and then there was really no need for another architect. So we have an executive architect. That was necessary because, for 20 yeah. years, you haven't kept up with law in any way. This is abroad, so and it's a pleasure working with a team anyway. I really like mm-hmm. working with other people, other teams, engineers. I don't like buildings to be you just do the design and then it's engineered. I like actually sort of working out a structure yeah. and construction that is logical, and then having an engineer come in and sort of work with you and refine it, not just to engineer it for you. It's a kind of process. And then with people like the suppliers of the stone, we have a great relationship, and all of those things are immensely pleasurable. So this has just been growing over the last few years. And I have to say, with no disrespect to academics at all, because I consider myself, I am an academic, that's mm-hmm. what I'm doing. It's just that it's, certainly grew up wanting to be an architect. It's just more fun doing it as opposed to writing about it. But actually now I've got yeah. over that a little bit. I really enjoy now doing the both, and it just depends, the balance can shift. It's a rather a luxury to be able to part of your time design, part of your time write, and part of the yeah. time teach. So I didn't expect this kind of reconciliation between design and history, but it just happened. So I was lucky.
Yeah. So that was a project in the Caribbean, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. And it's in a way, it's so strange, because I said earlier in my life, maybe a little bit unlucky with some projects. And this is totally lucky yeah. because it's a project almost as if I was born to do it, or, it was born so I could do it.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain it, because if a patron wants a particular Roman flavor, then it's not, I'm fairly expert in that kind of area. I can still draw either hand drawing or CAD. And I've still got a vague memory for things like bending moments or mathematical things. And I speak Italian, which is great when you're working with the Italian contractor and crafts mm-hmm. and so on. And we even ended up designing some wall paintings, and my sort of not very good skills at watercoloring and so on just came in handy. And then otherwise, of course, there's lots of things I can't do, like the 3D stuff and a lot more. But then you form a team, and I've been fantastically lucky and had really good members of the team. So there's the, great Jacob Ring, who is the job architect for the project. And there's been Victoria Schultz. Yeah. I don't know if you
met her. Surely.
She's also active also with teaching, now doing a PhD at the Prince's Foundation. So she's with us only, partially. And there's been others. And It's also been really great teaching at Bath, because of course I can sound out the students that are interested, because they show a real interest in the lectures. And then I can talk to design tutors and work out who's also a star in that field. So I've been able to have some really fantastic young architects working with me. So it's a great position.
Yeah, wonderful. Because meanwhile, you're still active as a professor in Bath. And
sorry to jump in there, Ruben, but I've just actually left the University of Bath. Okay. This is also a really good time, because you know, every now and then you need to recharge the batteries and rest. And so I have kind of more of a visiting professor status, and there's some opportunities opening up for next year, which will be good. And I've been doing some summer school teaching. So I was teaching on the Cambridge, the summer school of the Center for the Study of Classical Architecture there, where we also went to Engelsberg. Mm-hmm. That's got a tradition of summer school teaching before. And then it was also a pleasure this year to go and do some teaching at the Table Ronde. So, with Nadia and such great critics coming along, incredible what got done, including by school children. That was, and the word children, it sounds all wrong, because these are young adults who, you know, at the age of 17 or something, can produce incredible results. Really interesting to see.
Yeah.
Really enthusing.
Yeah. How were your experiences also at Engelsberg? The other summer schools, and what is your vision on these summer schools in general? Because they feel a certain gap in the educational landscape, you would say.
There is a huge gap, and it is it's sad that the the architectural establishment has become so monolithic, because I don't think that was necessary. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of things that we have to be as I say, people on the side of tradition and classical or similar, let's say, refined traditions, which there are others, of course, in the world. I think, you know, there can be this adversarial stance and so on, but I think we have to understand there were a lot of reasons why, after World War One, that a change seemed to be absolutely both inevitable and desirable. And that came with experimentation. It came with all kinds of risks and challenges, and a lot of things, with hindsight, didn't work so well. And I think what is the difficulty in architectural education is that there's been a lot of stubbornness to stick with these certain mantras, which work really well probably in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you start to see some successes for sure, but also some failures, there was the kind of refusal to admit to these failures for a long time, until it became palpably obvious when the public, you know, really took against a lot of the projects that were built after World War II.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me such a shame that there was so much sort of digging into the bunker, and that when you get people responding more traditional, or coming back, or asking, well, actually, some of these failures might be something we need to actually relearn, or we need to look more humbly at our context and our history, and not think we have to change everything, that we have to sweep everything away. And the climate was quite hostile. And I really feel uncomfortable both from any side that gets tribal about this, because there's really good, decent people who are modern architects, and there's very good and decent people who are classical or traditional architects. And you can learn a lot from history, and you can also learn from some of the changes and experimentation that has come about. So that's my kind of position. But the fact is that the balance is completely skewed. So you have countless numbers of architecture schools that stick to more or less a monolithic, with all the different strands, but a monolithic stance, not in favor of tradition. And then you have a very small minority that of schools that are either open tradition or actively teaching it, or these summer schools that are in a sense emerging because there's a demand out there, there's a need, there's a desire. And so these summer schools, which are relatively small, are responding to that need. And it's a shame it is so, let's say, the balance is all wrong. I mean, it would be, I wouldn't expect there to be hundreds of architecture schools which are teaching mainly classical or traditional design. But you would hope that there would be quite a few. So the option was there, just as when we think about eating or something. The modern world is incredibly full of choice, perhaps even too much choice. You know, you can eat any style, any mode. You know, you want, if you step out in the streets of a city, or you can also indulge your own preferences in your own kitchen. You know, the shops have an unbelievable amount of variety and choice, and you can do anything. But no, when it gets to architecture, it's like, no, we can only do certain things. And you know, these ideas like you have to be modern, and anything looking back to history is pastiche as in bad. It's kind of, as I say, it's a bit sad, it's a bit puerile, really. We should be able to have decent conversations with people who are really well informed, interested, sensitive, artistic, and as I said, would want to do good things. And so this kind of the dogma is the problem, not necessarily people and individuals and even the ideas, but it's when it gets dogmatic, then we're in trouble.
I must say that I've been involved with the Utrecht summer school, where we teach more kind of traditional urbanism, which has been very just a fantastic experience also to see that the students really living up, because they finally get the opportunity to do what they like and what they always wanted to do, which is just design traditional classical buildings and design ornaments. And I don't know, what were your experiences with students during the summer school, and how have you seen them experience this different type of design?
Well, I think it feels quite natural to a lot of people. It's almost strange to think the other way, you know, since that, when you think that as children we learn from our parents and they learn from their grandparents, and maybe, well, like this house, I mean, it's very sustainable. You know, I have furniture that my grandmother, probably great-grandmother had. So, and my daughter likes some of it, and maybe her daughter will. So, you know, incredibly sustainable. It just gets moved around different places, and every now and then you put a bit of polish on it or amend a little bit. And, you know, it's fairly natural to have a part of you that is coming from your roots.
Yeah.
So, and the whole idea of traditional culture, which is just normal, it's just normal living, that you inherit a certain amount of your DNA and your teaching and learning and habits from what's gone before you, and then you are different. You know, I'm not the same as my parents, and I've moved on. I listen to horrible music with drums or something, and which my dad couldn't stand. You know? So, but at the same time, I have some of his furniture. So, and I have some of his paintings on the wall. You know, this is normal. You have continuity, and you have the new, and they can work together. And I think it's also interesting to observe children, and very young children. You know, there's something really reassuring to children: familiarity, repetition. You know, a story you like, a film you like, they want to hear it again. You know, they feel comfortable, they feel secure, and so on. And same, you take the same child, the same children, and you give them a nice shock, a surprise, especially a surprise present or a surprise party or something, and they love that too. So, you know, they don't have to be completely separate things. And this idea of, I think I mentioned earlier, my research, I was interested to try and combat the idea that a tradition is just copying. Because, of course, it is imitation, but imitation is a much broader concept. And as Aristotle said, it goes all the way to invention. But necessity is the mother of invention. You only invent when there's a necessity, a need, a demand, a desire that maybe is responding to a societal demand, need, or desire. And then it makes sense. And if you are, if you like, a genius, and the Michelangelo or the Picasso or, you know, whoever, then you get an invention that somehow seems a revelation and it's game-changing. But when you have novelty for novelty's sake, innovation, invention, just, you know, that has no grounding behind it, no real need other than to distinguish yourself from someone else, then it's rather tedious. So I think, anyway, your question though, Ruben, sorry, I'm digressing, but your question was about people and teaching. And I think that some of these things just feel quite natural. And so they're quite relaxed and also just quite excited because, of course, they have their exercises to do. There will be a presumption in favor of a conceptual response and something that makes sense in terms of tradition and has some embedded common sense, but it doesn't mean that the responses are varied and individual. And if I can just add that actually at both the Table Ronde, so I was there for both the final reviews of the Table Ronde and for the Cambridge Summer School this year. And in both cases, it was notable how the responses to the brief were just as varied as you might expect in a normal architecture school. And that was particularly at Bruges, they had different sites. So, of course, you would get different responses. But at Cambridge, they had the same site. So you have 15 or 16 students doing the same problem on the same site. And you had 15 or 16 different responses. And some of them were really left field. You couldn't have predicted them. And then you looked at it and your first thought was, oh, gosh, that's a bit weird. That's a bit strange. Is that? And then you kind of, you know, you actually get in and think, well, actually, that's rather intelligent. You know, that's rather great. Would you do that? And, you know, you had, in a sense, the students teaching the professors because maybe we hadn't thought of that idea. So, no, it's a lovely thing, I think, this exchange between experience and youth.
Yeah, and of course, it's, I mean, the detractors of perhaps traditional design education would say, like, well, tradition is just copying the past, so you'll get you'll get always the same kinds of things. But that's not what you get. You get a lot of different designs. That's really fun to actually to hear. But perhaps moving on to a new subject, because you now have your own firm, Apollodorus Architecture. And you recently launched a scheme for a new rugby stadium in Bath. Could you tell me about that project from the very beginning? How it, what happened and what led up to this proposal and how you were able to create such a beautiful proposal, because it has already gotten some attention on social media. So, yeah, could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, it's, again, one of these things that you it's not planned or programmed and it just sort of emerged. I think I said at the beginning that I did some urban design back as a young architect and I'd qualified and there were two quite big schemes which did have a sort of traditional core to them. So I've always valued streets and squares. So the look wouldn't have been traditional classical, but it was basically something you could recognize urbanistically as, I think, hopefully some grain of common sense. But anyway, they were cancelled. And so, but you can imagine that I've, when I did a master plan once for the site of Volubilis, which is the premier sort of Roman site in Morocco. So, you know, I have had some master planning experience. And then practicing again and doing this project in the Caribbean, well, I, you know, obviously wasn't doing any urban design, but occasionally, you know, because of the time lags in a project as big as that, And with the need for executive architects and all the consultants and all the kind of, you know, cycles of iteration, we occasionally had some gaps. And Jacob, Victoria and I, we kind of thought, you know, what should we do with this time? And it could just be a day here or even a week there or bits and bobs. And we could have really prepared text and images for publication, which we have a fair amount prepared, but we didn't actually regard that as being the prime purpose. And you got some time. So that would carry on. But we also thought, well, I can't remember the exact sequence, but I think I thought, well, let's go and do a counter project. And I had a fantasy design, if you like, just, you know, and I had in mind a site for mm-hmm. London, but Jacob said, well, actually, why don't we do the Bath? The Bath wreck is always a problem. And so, well, there was me obviously teaching at the uni, there's Jacob living in Bath, and it seemed quite logical. And both Jacob and I think, but I would have seen more simply by virtue of teaching for over 20 years, I've seen several student projects go. And then you've had two quite, you know, big architectural firms produce designs over the years. And without wishing to be disparaging or anything, they just didn't seem to do the right thing. Doesn't mean they were bad, doesn't mean, you know, there might have been very good ideas, there might have been all kinds of positive traits, but overall just seemed to miss the target. And we just had the sort of intuition that if you did a kind of curving building, that might solve some of the problems. And particularly if you didn't just tackle the stadium by itself, because the situation needs understanding. You see, you have this green space, or was once a green space, running down to the river. And it's very central. It's right in the heart of Bath, because this bit of river is right across from the Abbey. So we're, and there's this bowl of hills going around, these green hills with these crescents and various terraces and sort of spilling down towards the bottom. And we're in the flat next to the river. It's obviously by definition just about the lowest point. And this sort of key site, but you have a 1970s temporary sort of steel stands of a stadium on three sides, and some hoarding and so on to protect the stands and make sure people don't go in there and when it's not match days and so on. So it's pretty sort of depressing boundary condition. And then to one side, on the other side along the river, you have this 1970s concrete leisure centre, which, you know, provides useful functions and services for the citizens of Bath, but in no way could be described as a beauty. You know, this, we're talking about a building with blank facades, plant rooms on the ground level, storage and car parking and so on. So it's, I say, not a thing of beauty. And we're right on the riverfront at Bath. So when we had the idea of doing this kind of oval, if you like, amphitheater-like kind of design, then it kind of unlocked the whole problem. So it created a softness with respect to the historic buildings and the landscape. At the same time, it invited you in to do something with this leisure centre. And by creating a new complex there, the whole site suddenly became permeable. Instead of being blocked off, at the moment, you can't go through between these two complexes. Or if you did, it's very nasty. You know, you wouldn't want to hang around there. So by creating this kind of plan, we also realized that you could create bars and restaurants and who knows, you know, other functions apart from the leisure center. And we all know that some traditional buildings are compatible with quite good densities. So you can really get the functions in. We didn't realize at first, but once we started drawing it, it just seemed to us that it had legs, so to speak. And then we drew some more, and we had another gap. And then when we had another gap, we drew some more, and the render, we started showing people, and basically it was, well, this, you know, either we convinced ourselves or other friends convinced us that it was worth sharing. And then we thought we would put it out there, which we were doing even before the latest iteration of Bath Rugby. So they picked new architects and they were coming up with a new design.
Oh, wow.
We didn't know that at first. But this new scheme was, you know, no better overall. It may have some better points and some worse points, but overall it still wasn't hitting the target as far as we could see. And Bath would be the worse for having the temporary problematic conditions made permanent, you see, because the lack of permeability, the lack of connections are one thing if notionally the building is temporary. You could always delude yourself that one day it's going to go and you're going to have your green space again. But a permanent building would consolidate all the problems. And then you really have to think, well, is that design good enough? And that sort of fired us up for extra energy to put it out there. We approached the rugby club, but they, and we, you know, said we sent them our images and our designs, but obviously they had engaged their architects. They're going down their route. They were worried about taking on a site with this complexity with these other stakeholders. So they carried on going. And, well, we thought, well, we better carry on too, because it then becomes, well, it becomes a sort of double activity in a way. It becomes a kind of showpiece for what we couldn't do. And we've been stretching our wings, enjoying doing this. And it's very different to our other designs. So there has been some other work, but very small scale. Lovely, lovely job in Italy, but say small scale. And this is quite a different thing. And then on the other hand, I think we just believe that we're doing the right thing for Bath, because if we can contribute to some common sense returning and to people ultimately achieving a better vision rather than let this rather expedient solution go through that, say, completely consolidates all the problems rather than liberating us from the problems.
Yeah,
I think ultimately it would be damaging for Bath to have this building built, essentially, for its heritage, for its world health, world heritage site status. And, you know, it would be also not a great waterfront experience. So all in all, we just felt that we had, if you like, a duty to contribute to the debate and maybe hopefully lead people in a different direction.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you think, how was the... Well, the design received, and how was the social, also the reception on social media? Because you, well, it was shared also on the social media account of, I think, La Table Ronde. So, yeah, and that, I think, has brought it pretty far. And, yeah, it also reached me. I absolutely loved the design when I saw it. I almost couldn't believe it, because I've been in Bath twice, and I know that waterfront, and it's pretty horrible, and it's really
yeah, you can confirm
screams
that.
For help, you could say.
Yes.
Yeah, I can definitely confirm that. So, but yeah, how was it received, and do you notice any hostility towards the plan from the municipality, or is there any reception, and what would you need to do to make sure that that perhaps this plan could be taken serious,
Let's say there are obstacles to implementing such a thing. There are many, so we shouldn't get carried away. But let's start with reception. I think we put it out there, and because actually it was, I think, Conor Lynch who was first, and then Table Ronde, and then others, and then it gets retweeted and reposted. And I think there was one tweet that had, or post, I'm not very good with social media myself, I should say, that had, you know, 200 million views, and it has become really quite visible considering how it started. So there's been lots of great support, and we get comments into our website. Obviously, we get people messaging us and emailing us and so on. So there's a lot of people who are really enthusiastic, and they say rather like they just can't believe that this kind of thing could be proposed or even be hypothetically possible. So then obviously you also get some kickback, which would be quite reasonable and quite expected, because there's teams of people who have been putting in work into what they've been doing. The rugby club has supporters who quite love their game, love playing in the centre of town. I mean, I think it's fantastic that they have a stadium in the centre of town. I'm not anything against that as a principle. So, but, you know, you get worried, well, will this derail the planning application by the club? And so, therefore, there is some kickback. I think, apart from some sort of knee-jerk comments that you can sort of predict with social media, it hasn't been too bad. I feel I don't feel unsafe as I walk down the street. You know, I think it's okay. But let's say that haven't had from anyone in authority in Bath sort of a positive, you know, invitation to come and show them what we're proposing, or ideas or justifications and so on. First of all, there's the concerns that people have who are into rugby, that it might impair their chances of getting their stadium through. And secondly, there are concerns over cost. But actually, there are concerns over cost existing or proposal for the new stadium, because the rugby club, it doesn't have... I mean, there are question marks, let's say, over its finances. Rugby is in a slightly unfortunate position recently, because there's much more concern about the dangers of concussion and so on, and impact sports on the long-term future health of players. You might know about this. You know, same with boxing and so on. It's not to rugby. There are...
It's quite physical.
It's very physical, yes. So there are these concerns. And I say that some people think, well, you're not really helping, which is obvious. But it's not done out of nastiness, or it's done because we think it's not right for Bath. And so that's really the primary thing. Then there's people who say, well, it's actually not really a fair comparison, because, you know, the rugby club has put forward a relatively economical scheme. You know, it could be built for, you know, X million. And then you're putting out this image that would certainly cost more. Well, we don't know how much more, but let's say it's going to be 2X. So then you say, well, that's not fair, because you're not comparing like to like. But then the problem is, it's so not comparing like to like, you don't know where to start, because the steel... rugby club would never be able to generate the kind of return on investment that ours would, because ours would be much more conducive for other events such as concerts. The whole principle of this arcade going around lends itself to retail activities or bars and so on, where there's actually going to be income. And then the fact of the leisure centre means that offers bars, restaurants, perhaps even a hotel, besides the other leisure centre activities that most of them can be retained. So it's a completely different proposition. It's way more expensive overall, because you're doing the leisure centre as well. And then but it would last a long time. The stadium would only last, you know, a certain amount of years. And then it would, as a lot of modern buildings, they tend to be renewed after a few decades. Okay, there is now more attention in sort of refurbishment and in keeping structures that are sound and refacing them, but that's still an expensive business. It's still a sort of carbon heavy business. So, you know, John Wood and the people who built Bath in the 18th century, they're leftist buildings that are still around today, and they are, by the nature of traditional buildings, relatively easy to convert for other functions.
As we can see.
I mean, there's a limit to how you convert a stadium for other things, but as I say, the rest of it could adapt itself to other functions, and who knows, other sports, concerts, manifestations of some kind could find a home there. So it's idealistic, clearly, but it's not completely crazy. It just needs a very long-term vision.
I would say anything but, since if everybody's extremely concerned about sustainability nowadays, and the scheme that is proposed, well, by the other architects, doesn't look like a building that will stand there for generations. I mean, it looks rather fashionable in a way, with the current fashion and the very minimalist, but this arena proposal, I would see... I could see this standing for, well, hundreds of years, if it is built with the right materials and not with steel, which can have the water reach the rebar and then it expands and there's cracks in the concrete.
The steel in reinforced concrete is ultimately the biggest problem in a lot of buildings, One thing that would be said in favor of this kind of construction is you wouldn't need so much of it integrated within the stone. You say you have a tensile structure or whatever on top, keeping some sort of flexible roof or whatever. Clearly that would be steel, but that could be dismantled and redone without dismantling the whole structure. And then with such a sort of solid construction of those piers, one could probably do that kind of construction without ferrous materials. So you can have, pretty thick stone, a core, or even of recycling some of the concrete that would come from the demolitions of, in our vision, the demolitions of the center. And then you'd have to come up with with very good engineers, you'd have to come up with a good solution for the loads and the wind loads and the lateral forces and so on, but to trying to avoid ferrous reinforcement. And if you did that, then yes, it should just sit there for hundreds of years without a problem. And then you renew maybe, say, the metal or whatever materials are put on top of this solid structure. So, and the obviously stone has a lower carbon footprint. There's abundant local stone in the quarries around Bath. Transportation is quite simple. But obviously, it's expensive because the stone has to be quarried, and then labour costs are quite different to back in the day of John Wood or the Romans. But it's not completely crazy. There are savings if you look in terms of carbon and sustainability finance, if you take a sufficiently long-term view, bearing in mind particularly this also supply of stone. And on that point, actually, I've been talking to the companies that produce stone, and particularly gone into some detail. And there is the kind of local legend that actually Bath stone is running out, that you can only use it for conservation projects, but it's going, that's true only of one seam. There are other seams, and they are seams that are in the course of being opened up with proper, let's say, green technologies that are much more sustainable than the old quarries. So this is not actually pie in the sky.
I recently talked to a very knowledgeable stone expert, and there is such extreme amounts of stone. Maybe, of course, Bath is a very specific type of stone, but well, you've already done the effort to confirm there's more out there. You can win it electrically. You can use electric drills and saws, and even move it electrically if you want to electrically move it. So Yeah.
You know, it would be lovely in some ways to have craft involvement and do some of the moldings that one would need in a traditional way. But if that's not possible, we've got experience on that Caribbean project with using CNC cutting and highly precise. I mean, it's millimetric precision. So everything comes together and joins. It's shipped out from Italy. It comes, you know, from the pencil to the computer.
Yeah.
And it appears in Dropbox or whatever in Italy, and then it gets produced, and then it goes out the Caribbean, and guess what? It joins, fits. So this can be done, and I'm sure that actually I would guess that with a commission like this, a stone company would equip themselves with the necessary CNC cutting machines to produce the stuff relatively efficiently and more economically than you might suspect, given the proximity. Actually, with the so-called Southgate development in Bath, this was done, I don't know if you want to know about this, Ruben, or your listeners, but this was done in a way that I find rather regrettable in some ways. And it was thought necessary at the time to have the Bath stone cut to 5 centimeter thicknesses, have it shipped out to Italy to be CNC cut, or maybe the blocks were sent out. But anyway, the stone in some form was sent from the Bath area out to Italy.
Oh, wow.
Cut and shifted back to somewhere else in Britain where it was bonded onto concrete or whatever they did. I mean, I may not get the precise technical details correct because I wasn't there, and I didn't, but that was the overall picture. And then you come back and you face it in this way on modern construction, and the detailing isn't so satisfactory, and one has to question all of that. I'm pretty convinced it could happen that you would quarry the stone locally, you would work it locally, and it would just come from the hills around to work sites down in Bath or be delivered there, and that would all be done locally and possibly extremely efficiently with CNC cutting, depending on all of these sort of calculations to do with craft or not craft. But I think it's doable. But Ruben, we shouldn't get carried away, because the phrase that's meant to slip between cup and lip, here's the glass or the cup, and between there and there, lots of things can happen. And first of all, it's quite possible that Bath Rugby's scheme gets through, it gets planning permission. It's quite possible they resolve all the sort of legal disputes and difficulties over covenants and such like that there are. It's possible that happens. And were that not to happen, it would take a lot of meeting of minds to come together and realize that this thing could be financed. There would be investors. I know that for certainty because I've been contacted by a funder of developments, key developments in Britain that have been very successful. And so the will would be there, but then you have to confront all the heritage issues. You have to confront the risk of flooding. There's a lot of issues. So, but the seed is there if people want it. More difficult things have been done.
Yeah.
HS2 hasn't been done as it should have been, you know, and it's not for me to hold out, I think, too great hopes. It's just, wouldn't it be wonderful? And there's the idea. Yeah. And then it would be for others to come along and make it happen.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a wonderful idea. And I hope that this podcast, or maybe in some form, I can help spread the word and get this proposal out to more people, that perhaps something positive comes from it. Yeah, maybe a final question. Do you have anything you want the audience to know, or anything else to share before we end this interview?
Oh, that's good of you, Ruben. I can't think we covered so much. I mean, my worry is that there's so much there.
Yeah.
I suppose one thing that we haven't quite said that I think is implicit, it's not just carrying on tradition in a sense and transforming it and moving it on And so you get new traditions, and you get the whole thing evolving and living. Personally, you think I would say that, but of course, I believe there is value in studying history quite attentively, so that it's not just, let's say, going with the flow, but there's the serious side of studying can be very rewarding in its own right, but it can also then give you great confidence in acting as a designer. Perhaps when I was a younger man, you feel a bit anxious when you're designing. You feel a bit insecure. There's lots of questions in your mind. Have you got this right? Is that really the right thing? And you take bits of information from somewhere and you try and navigate your way through to coming up with a proposal or ideas and then designs and then, you know, the details. And there's lots of quite reasonable insecurities, particularly when you're doing contemporary stuff that isn't relying too much on the tried and tested, because you can't be absolutely sure that what you're proposing is going to work. So, and then you're trying to rival your peers. You're trying to maybe come up with something that is more novel or more interesting or more wacky or whatever it is. So there's a lot of insecurity and anxiety. I found, I'm not trying to deride other people, I'm just saying personally. And now, doing what I'm doing, I feel hopefully not overconfident, because always be learning, you know, there's always, we can improve, but I feel that I've consolidated a knowledge from all these measuring of buildings and analyzing the archaeology and the history and writing it and getting publications out in scholarly journals and so on, and then books, is that it gives you a kind of security and a kind of base, a platform from which to then produce things. So, for example, you mentioned the Tower of the Winds columns, but I have if you like, the pleasure of just being able to just produce that stuff from scratch. I don't have to look at a book or get out photographs, because the stuff's in there and the measurements, the proportions, I know them by heart. I'm not necessarily know that particular column, you know, but I know the methods by which these things were done. And so I can produce my own one, which is going to recall the other one, but in a vague way, because I haven't actually gone and borrowed it directly. It's sort of gone into one's gut and then it comes up again. Hopefully that's why it's not a very nice analogy, is it? But it's quite nice having that history and that knowledge behind one. I think that has to be said, that there is a virtue in all these studies and so on. So it's not just, I don't know, following recipes, or I think that's what people think. You know, there is some idea that I said earlier, you're just copying stuff. It's not like that.
Exactly. No, but it's really funny, by the way, you also mentioned a lot of things about the trouble with always wanting to be original and the unrest that gives mostly for students who get insecure because they haven't any solid ground to stand on, any solid ground of years of research of what has been done before. So I can imagine really well that it gives some comfort and it gives some self-confidence to have that precedence to build on. And I also believe that it could even lead to better buildings in the end, because you're relying on things that are proven to work. So, very helpful also for my own thinking about precedent and the relation to originality in work or novelty.
I would, if I can synthesize that, I think you learn principles and you try and ingest them, if you like, assimilate them. And then you produce stuff generatively with axes and rhythms and so on, just like a modern architect would do. Or you look at Renaissance sketches, and they're very diagrammatic and conceptual by Renaissance architects. And then you build up your scheme. And then, I then go and look at things. You know, once you've got an idea of where you're going, then it's also great to then see how so-and-so did it, you know, whether it's San Michele or Palladio or Schinkel or even Kahn or something. And you kind of have this fun business of sort of testing your creativity against you get kind of instruction. You get, you know, you get tutors that aren't just tutors. You get tutored by history that's gone before you, and at the same time, you have the creative challenge of moving it on, adapting it to your circumstances and situation and current ways of doing things. And it's quite exciting as a mixture.
Yeah. I think I can just only say thank you so much for sharing all this wonderful material, also about the project, about your own experiences in education and life, for this podcast. And I look forward to seeing you sometime again, perhaps in Bath, perhaps somewhere else.
Absolutely. No, it would always be a pleasure, Ruben. And we have also the organization Traditional Architecture Group, TAG, and
yeah.
There's activities and, you know, events that we might call on you to contribute to. So that would be good. Otherwise, there's Bath, there's London, or there's one of the summer schools. So I'm sure we'll meet before long. So, the summer will be round again before we notice.
Yeah. Well, if you have time left in your calendar in summer, well, maybe we might also invite you for the Utrecht Summer School. But I can imagine with already two summer schools on your plate, it might be a bit much. But certainly looking forward, and always fun to be in Bath, because it's just such a beautiful place to come to. Then I'm going to thank you again. And for the listeners, all the links can be found in the description. But for now, just thank you, Mark, and till next time.
Well, thank you, Ruben. That was great. And thank you to your audience, or those of you who have had the patience to listen to the very end.
Wonderful.
Bye then.
Thank you for listening to the Aesthetic City podcast. For more information about the Bath proposal, Apollodorus architecture, and the works of Mark Wilson Jones, find the links in the description. If you like our content and want to support what we do, you can support us in various ways. The easiest way is to give this podcast a favorable review. Another way to support this podcast is to share it with colleagues and friends. You can also follow us on X, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or our Substack newsletter. And finally, the ultimate way to support The Aesthetic City is to become a patron. Find the Patreon link in the description. For more information about this platform, visit theaestheticcity.com. Thank you, until next time.